Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, Larry Mueller here. I'm going to begin our program today by talking with you about child abuse and child abuse prevention, as importantly. This is April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, and it's a chance for all of us to become a little more aware of situations that occur, unfortunately, in probably any community you can imagine. And sometimes it occurs in families or in areas where you might even least expect it. So we can talk about that with our two guests today from Safe Harbor here in Madison. Brenda Nelson is the executive director of Safe Harbor, holds a master's degree in social work and a licensed clinical social worker. Jennifer Ginsburg is forensic interviewer for Safe Harbor. She also has a master's degree in social work and is a licensed clinical social worker. So they'll be talking about what they do and what Safe Harbor does. I hope you will join in with your questions and with your comments. Maybe you or someone close to you has experienced abuse as a child. How has it impacted you? What did you do about it? Those are questions you might ask, or you might have some general questions about Safe Harbor, what it is, what it does, how you might get involved even. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Brenda Nelson, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting us.
And Jennifer Ginsburg, thank you as well.
Good morning. Thank you.
Let's talk a little bit about, and maybe I'll turn to you first, Brenda. What is the extent of child abuse? What types of child abuse do you see? Maybe talk about it that way. What is the extent of child abuse in this state or in this country?
When we talk about child abuse, we talk about children that potentially were physically abused. That can involve being whooped with a belt or an extension cord, bruising, other things that cause wounds, cigarette burns. We also talk about sexual assault, and that can consist of touching in private areas of a child, overclothing, underclothing, even to the most egregious type of assault. We also work with children that we say are victims of violent crimes. They may witness domestic violence or homicides, and we also work with children that are believed to be victims of neglect. So we sort of cover the gamut.
Yeah, that's and how frequent are you busy? Unfortunately,
my staff and I really, truly feel if child abuse would go away and we'd be all out of a job tomorrow, that wouldn't be a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But it isn't going away. I think the most frustrating thing that we know and we realize is that it is preventable. There are things that happen to children that are not preventable. There are types of childhood cancer that are not preventable. You diagnose it, you treat it. But child abuse is preventable. And it doesn't need to exist in our society. It doesn't need to exist in Dane County, but it still does. April is nationally known as Child Abuse Prevention Awareness Month, and each year for the past 4 years, Safe Harbor, along with our partner agencies, has done something to try to increase public awareness about the incidence of abuse in Dane County. And for the first 3 years, we planted pinwheels, and each pinwheel we planted represented a report of abuse or neglect called into Dane County Human Services. This year, we went to a new public awareness project, and it was called the Blue Ribbons and Trees. And we were very fortunate that Grace Episcopal Church down in the square allowed us to string 5,940 blue ribbons in their trees. And what that meant was during 2010, that many calls were made to Dane County Human Services to report the possibility of a child being a victim of abuse or neglect.
Hmm. And this is just Dane County.
This is Dane County.
And you could, we've got 71 others. Places, counties around the state, and, you know, I suppose depending on the population numbers, but it probably exists to a similar extent, at least proportionally, in every county.
It does. I mean, I think proportionally Dane County is not excessive. I mean, we know the number is underreported. There are many cases of abuse or neglect that never get reported. The thing that we try to communicate to the people in our community is, let go of your wrong assumptions. Yes, abuse does happen in your neighborhood. Yes, it does happen to children that go to school with your children. Yes, it happens in the high-end neighborhoods, and yes, it happens in the lower economic neighborhoods. Yes, it happens to children that are in Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts. It is not something that you can pick the perfect place and live in a cocoon and say it'll never happen to you, mm-hmm. because unfortunately it does.
And it is underreported. How is it typically reported? Is it...
Very often with a child, especially with physical abuse, they may go to school and they may tell the teacher. And that is something that traditionally would happen in the home with an adult caregiver. With sexual abuse, a child may tell in a variety of ways. They may tell their parent because somebody in the family abused them, or somebody living next door abused them, or somebody in their life abused them. They may tell the teacher. Quite often with teen girls, it's not unusual. They tell their best friend, and the best friend will say to them, well, you got to tell your mom. And the child is hesitant to do so because they don't want to get in trouble, or they don't want to disappoint their parents, or they're embarrassed, or they're shy. So the friend will tell her mom, and then her mom calls the mom of the victim. So children tell in a variety of ways, and sometimes they hold that secret for very many years until they feel it's safe to let go of the secret.
If you learn, I mean, in certain cases, if it's mandatory, isn't it, to report? If someone were to tell me that, or I learned that someone was being abused, wouldn't it be mandatory for me to contact?
There are many professionals that are mandated by license to report. Social workers, doctors, nurses, teachers, therapists, with newer laws, ministers, priests. There are many people that are mandated reporters. And I would like to believe that the majority of those professionals understand the mandate and do follow through and report. We do episodically see a case coming in where we knew that the child had been with somebody that was a mandated reporter and they didn't report. And so we want to educate those people, too. It's their obligation. It's a moral responsibility even more than that. It's our job to keep the kids safe.
Oh, absolutely. Talking today with Brenda Nelson and Jennifer Ginsberg of Safe Harbor during this April, which is Child Abuse Prevention Month. Great to have them with us. And certainly if you have questions or experiences to share, I hope you'll join us at 1-800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. So you provide, as I read things, a safe place for people to, or for children to tell their story and adults to tell their stories?
That is exactly right.
Yeah.
The whole concept for Safe Harbor started about 12 years ago, and it started with the belief by the chief of police and the sheriff and the district attorney at the time that there had to be a better way in Dane County to be able to help children that were reported or believed to be victims of abuse. And they with great wisdom looked at other models. They looked at a Chicago model, they looked at a Minneapolis model, they looked at some of the smaller community models and said, we really want to have a place for children to come to that looks friendly, that's safe, where they can talk to a trained professional in a way that allows them to tell their story, where they feel supported, and where mom and dad feel supported also. And so then they set about opening up Safe Harbor. Before that, typically children were interviewed either at school, and that was embarrassing for them if they were pulled out of the classroom, or they were taken to the police department, which can be in its own way a scary place to go, or they were interviewed at Human Services. And it wasn't a place that felt friendly and safe. And so that was the whole foundation of Safe Harbor, a place for kids to come, talk to somebody that can talk to them in a way that's non-leading, non-suggestive, allow the child to tell the story in their own words, and have other staff there that can provide the support to the protective adult to help them cope with what is happening in their family.
Yeah. And Jennifer, you are a forensic interviewer. It sounds kind of... CI, whatever that television program is,
right.
CSI. That's what it is. CSI, I think, is the show. But that's not what you do. What do you do? What's your role as a forensic interviewer?
Well, a forensic interview is a fact-finding interview, and like Brenda said, it's a way to let the child tell their story in a way that that makes sense to them with their own words, using drawings and conversation, and to really help support the child to say what they need to say. It's difficult for children to talk about what happened to them, partly because they're always so concerned about the people around them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they worry about their parents, they worry about their family, they don't want other people to be affected and to suffer, and so they're not sure what they can say, they're not sure what other people's reactions are going to be. So in the forensic interview, you know, they can talk in detail about what happened to someone who they don't have to take care of, mm-hmm. for someone who's going to support them and attend to them. And that makes it a safe and supportive environment for them to talk about what happened.
And I suppose it's a tricky thing, or maybe it's not. I would view it as a tricky, not to to allow them to talk without leading them down one lane or a direction or another.
Yes, and we follow a specific protocol for forensic interviewing, which is exactly what you said, where it's non-leading, non-suggestive. Yeah. It's really about the child's words, you know, that where the child is given a forum to use their words. And my job is to be a really good listener.
Good listener.
And then, you know, if they talk about something, like I'm looking at your shirt there, you know, talk about the red stripes on somebody's shirt, like, you know, tell me more about that shirt. Tell me more about what happened at the park. And it's really just about sort of prompting the questions based on what they say, you know, not at all leading in suggestions. Yeah. 'Cause that doesn't help. Anybody.
No.
That doesn't help the child. That doesn't help the situation. And it's fact finding. Like, I don't go in with a presumption of anything. I go in to be a good listener and to give the child a safe space and a supportive environment to talk about what happened.
Well, let's take some calls. Boyd in Milwaukee up first here. Boyd, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Good morning, Larry. Good morning to your guests. Well, you know, something that I think a lot of people might grapple with. You know, I know there are different kinds of abuse. Certainly, there's physical abuse, which unfortunately is very documented when, you know, you see some of the graphic photos, and even more so, there's sexual abuse. How is verbal abuse looked at in terms of, because, you know, sometimes, of course, when parents have to lay down the law, maybe they, you know, have to, you know, on those hopefully rare occasions, raise their voice. But what I'm talking about is when someone, and you don't even know after a while if they're reprimanding their children, but just using the most crudest, foulest language, or they could be humiliating them in public. And, you know, kids and adolescents, you know, are very insecure and are very, you know, are, as you said, very concerned about what people think about them. And I would have to think that the effects in some ways are just as damaging. And some people say even more so. And your thoughts.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Boyd. Appreciate it. And, well, Brenda, do you want to start? We can have you both chime in here. Brenda, first.
Verbal abuse comes under the category of emotional abuse. And one of the things that we really need to point out is that Wisconsin law allows for centers like Safe Harbor to be available to interview children and to record that interview on a DVD or digitally record it. It's called hearsay evidence. It will then allow that evidence to be used in the criminal prosecution later on if it's determined that a criminal act has been committed. Physical abuse, as your caller said, in its own unique way, is sometimes easier to prove because you have the cuts, the bruises, the burns, the belt marks.
Right.
Sexual abuse is more challenging to prove because very often you don't have findings. But with the use of the forensic interview, it allows the child, again in their words, to tell all the details of where were you and where was she, where was he, what were you wearing, what were you hearing, and gather all of that information and then have enough to be able to perhaps go ahead with a prosecution or a substantiation by human services.
Yeah.
Emotional abuse under Wisconsin law or under any state's law is much more challenging to prove a criminal act has occurred. What we do with children that come to Safe Harbor and when we interview them is empower them to say, this is a safe place to talk. it's okay to use those words here, even if there are words that you've been told are foul language or inappropriate. This is an okay place for you to tell us what you heard, what people said. It may then get rolled into the other types of abuse that brought them in, but it is much more challenging. Psychologically, it is extremely damaging, but it is much more challenging to prove. Mm.
Yeah, Jennifer, something to add there?
No, but just like what your caller said, that it is one of those areas that, you know, there, it's much more difficult to come to light. And people are very, you know, as a culture, we really think that sort of the family has to sort of have their space to do things their own way. You know, we're very hesitant to intervene and in what we, you know, in what we see. And yeah, the verbal abuse is certainly so heavy and damaging for a child. And when I am interviewing a child, we always talk about not only the physical acts that happened, but what did the person say? And how did you feel? Mm-hmm. And what were you thinking? You know, and all this, the child's feelings, the child's thoughts, what was being said to the child at the time. It's always very revealing about the sort of larger emotional context that the child's dealing with.
Yeah. Talking today with Brenda Nelson and Jennifer Ginsberg from Safe Harbor. They work a lot with children who have been abused. This is Child Abuse Prevention Month. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments. Larry Mueller here. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Net as we talk about child abuse prevention. Hope you'll join in with your own questions and comments. Maybe you've had experiences. Maybe you yourself was abused as a child or know someone who was. How has it impacted you? And do you have questions about Safe Harbor as well? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Isthmus News Magazine this week, and Isthmus, for those out around the state, is produced and written and put together right here in Madison and distributed pretty much, I assume, in the Dane County area, but it goes out as well. It's online and so forth. But their featured piece last week, Brenda, had to do with Safe Harbor, but also with a young woman who was sexually abused as starting at a very young age. It was hard to read the article in some ways, but it was also very revealing and interesting to learn how her situation was dealt with.
I think the message from the young woman, which really exemplifies the work we do, is that what a difference it makes when a team of professionals come together to help a child. And when you hear this young woman speak, she will readily acknowledge the help she got from the social worker from Human Services, the detective from the sheriff's office, the DA that chose to prosecute the case, the victim witness specialist that's an advocate for her in the DA's office, and the mental health providers that really helped put herself back together as things moved along. She's an amazing young woman. If we ever ask ourselves, the people that do the work we do, why we do it, we just need to spend a little bit of time with her, because we see the smile on her face, we see the twinkle in her eye, and it reaffirms that when we do good work together as a team and we get the right type of mental health services for the children after we've identified that they have been abused, that they can stabilize, they can have good lives, and they can go forward and be productive adults, and that's what we're all about.
Well, and she received such quality help that she is now so motivated to help others. I mean, you know, her experience was that there are people out there who will help me. And that, you know, for children who are abused, they're incredibly isolated, alone, and to then have that healing experience where there are people who will surround them and support them and help them heal. And now she is incredibly strong and wanting to give back. And, you know, that's just incredibly gratifying for everyone and just speaks to a lot of hope for a lot of people out there.
And when someone comes in, just to talk more procedurally on this, you will often, or maybe always, I'm not sure, have perhaps law enforcement or others not in the room with her, but perhaps observing from outside. Is that true? How does that exactly does that work?
It's a great question, because in order for children to come into Safe Harbor, a report first has to be made either to the Department of Human Services or law enforcement. They do the initial screening, they gather the initial information, and then they will call Safe Harbor and say, we'd like to bring the child in to be interviewed. At that time, we start putting together the plan for the interview. And the really good thing about Safe Harbor is the child, when she's talking about what's happened to her, is only talking to one person.
Yeah.
She's either talking to Jennifer or she's talking to one of the other people that we've trained to do forensic interviews. We have a number of detectives, both in Madison Police Department and the Sheriff's Office, that interview for us, as well as social workers at Human Services. And then through a closed-circuit TV feed in another room is where the team can monitor the interview and watch it as it goes along. Mm-hmm. So in that room, there would be somebody from the district attorney's office, either a felony DA or a juvenile DA. There would be a victim witness specialist, the social worker assigned to the case from Human Services, the detective assigned to the case. If we identify that the alleged offender has already been in prison or has a probation and parole officer, they're also invited to come and observe the interview, because they can make decisions about what to do about the offender. And we tell the child that when they come in, they know where the cameras are in the room. They know where the microphone is. We're not about to keep secrets from them. But with the really good skills that our interviewers have, they forget about those things. And then they just get involved in talking. And we're listening and monitoring. And then we can also, through an earpiece and an audio pack, very subtly feed into the interviewer if we need a clarification or if somebody has a question.
Yeah. That they can go ahead and do that then and ask that extra question.
Can I add one thing? Is the other thing that Safe Harbor offers, and I think adults who are listening to the show right now who may have been through this as a child will see is perhaps different than their experience, is that with Safe Harbor, a child doesn't need to be interviewed time after time after time after time. That it used to be that sort of every party involved, a teacher, a social worker, a prosecutor, a detective, I mean, they might be interviewed 10, 12 times. And what Safe Harbor does is, while it might sound sort of intimidating to think all these people in another room watching, what it does is that it brings it down to one conversation that this child can talk one time in detail, and everybody's hearing the same thing. It keeps kids from falling through the cracks. And then you have a team of people who then are all in a room together, who are then able to plan and discuss and look out for all the needs of the kid at once. And, it's an incredible coordination of service that benefits the child and the family in so many ways.
And I can envision a situation where it would be good to have this recorded. I could see a time where maybe 3 or 4 years would go by before there would even be some prosecution. And then that 11-year-old girl is 14 or 15 years. And it's sort of a totally different kind of, memories go, there's so many things that could happen. So to have that recorded, I assume those get saved and for a time at least.
They're evidence. We do not keep any of that evidence at Safe Harbor. It always leaves with the detective assigned to the case. But the judges in Dane County are very receptive and supportive of the work we do. And so when they know an interview has been done at Safe Harbor, they know from the detective as the case is going forward that there would be a DVD that they could use in court. If it goes to trial, it does not preclude the child not having to be in the courtroom, but the judges will often allow the DVD to be played as their testimony and the child not having to be on the stand testifying piece by piece. And you hit upon a key point. I mean, with cases that go to trial, it's often at least a year, if not more, before it goes to trial. And my best example is when you think in your mind about a little girl at the age of 10 who comes in and we interview her and she talks about some very painful things that have happened to her. And she may look like your little 10-year-old next door. Yeah. And by the time she's 11 or 12, as children change so rapidly, what the jury's seeing is not that 10-year-old. And what we want them to see is not only the testimony, but the demeanor and the affect. It was a 10-year-old child that was egregiously abused.
Let's go to Mary in Whitefish Bay next. Mary, hello. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I wish that this service was around back in the 60s when I grew up. I suffered from abuse, severe abuse, and as a result of that, I became anorexic and bulimic, something I've suffered with for my entire life. During that time, family abuse was just not something that you would talk about outside of your family. And the one time I did try to tell someone, the response I got was to take me home and to tell my parents what I had said that was happening in the house. And, of course, it got worse for me afterwards when that person left. And it's just nice to know that there is a service now for children to be safe and to know that they're going to be believed and that they're going to get the services that they need. I wish I would have had that.
Oh. Thanks so much for calling. Comments, Jennifer?
Well, just that your story is so familiar. I mean, we just hear that time after time after time. The world has really changed, I mean, in really good ways. We are talking about things now that we never used to talk about, and it certainly has opened doors. I mean, obviously, we're not where we hope we would be in terms of eliminating child abuse, but there's certainly many more services and resources available for children, and people in Dane County we're really fortunate to have Safe Harbor and the services that we do here.
To what extent are there safe harbors, or I shouldn't say other
child advocacy centers?
Child advocacy mm-hmm. centers, yes, in other counties. I assume in every county, one would hope that there would be ready access.
There are 14 centers in Wisconsin. The first one opened in Rock County in Janesville. The second opened Children's Hospital in Milwaukee, and Safe Harbor was the third. There tends to be two different types of model, and one is a medical model where the child advocacy center is housed in a hospital and they can do the medical exams there as well as the forensic interviews, or a model like Safe Harbor where you're a freestanding private nonprofit and you then have a memorandum of understanding with the hospitals to do the medical exams. The movement started in Huntsville, Alabama, and it started about 30 years ago. And as with most movements, it was a little slow to come to the Midwest. But since Safe Harbor opened 12 years ago, we've seen tremendous growth in Wisconsin. Most of the centers serve more than their own county, and it's not unusual for Safe Harbor to also do cases for Richland and Sauk and Iowa and Columbia and Jefferson County. We also receive requests from the FBI. We have worked with the Texas Rangers and the California Highway Patrol, as long as there is a law enforcement jurisdiction that wants us to help them because the child perhaps lives here, but something happened to them in another state.
Sure.
We're more than willing to serve them.
Wow. So I think I'll go back to the phones for a minute here. I had a thought and it just blew out of my mind. And so while I'm rethinking that, let's go to Sheree in Waupun. Sheree, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. Wonderful subject. I appreciate it very much. I wanted to talk about the issue of domestic violence in homes. I was a domestic violence facilitator in Florida, and we were really strict about that. Usually, if there was a altercation that took place in the home, if the kids were home, CPS, Child Protective Services, would come in and give you one warning and let you know that if it happened again, that your kids would be removed. And they followed through with it. And it was in an effort to break the cycle, because just like abuse, you know, that is cyclical as well. And unfortunately, when I came to Wisconsin, I didn't really see that taking place as much. I was a little, you know, distraught about that because, you know, the only models that kids get to see of relationships, adult relationships, are the ones that are modeled at home. And so, you know, when they get into it being adults, they don't know that it's not correct to not hit or to be hit and to not take that type of abuse. So I wanted to hear the discussion on that.
Okay. Thank you for calling. Jennifer, Brenda, start with you.
I wish we had a stronger model that could perhaps allow in Wisconsin CPS to be more assertive in going in and removing children. It is not typically the model. What we have done is worked very carefully to train law enforcement, who are 99.9% of the time the first responders on domestic violence cases. to be very mindful if they go into the home to see if children are there, and to then realize that children can hear things and see things and witness things. And if that's the case, we should be interviewing that child at a center like Safe Harbor to talk about what they observed and what they know. I think we in our community work very carefully and very closely with domestic abuse intervention services to partner on being creative and being proactive in trying to assist parents and families that are living in domestic violence homes. We haven't made the problem go away, but I think we're trying to be as responsible as the law really allows us to.
When your violence is being reported, it probably doesn't usually get reported directly to you. It goes...
Right.
Law enforcement first. That's where the call goes. And depending upon law enforcement jurisdiction, depending upon whether it's the middle of the night or weekend or holiday, we'll let them know about the availability of the human services workers to be involved. Law enforcement will determine if there is a safe place for the child. If they are arresting the offender, which is most often dad, and if it's believed that either mom has been injured to the point she needs medical care or it's not a safe place for the child, they will at that moment be working to identify a safe place, whether it's a next-door neighbor, whether it's a grandparent. If they can't identify that immediately, then they will call human services to say, we have a child that needs placement, at least for a temporary period of time.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've remembered now the question that was kind of fleeting through my head, and that related to funding, because you mentioned sort of in passing that you were a nonprofit. So immediately what came to mind and then flew out, but now is back in, is how then do you fund yourself?
It's an interesting land to be in. Safe Harbor opened in September of 2001. About 10 days before 9/11, and I remember saying to the chair of our board at the time, this is going to be a very interesting time to start a new agency and fundraise when the economy is crashing around us. The funding for Safe Harbor comes in a variety of ways. Because we work with victims of crime, we're eligible for grants that come from the Department of Justice at the Fed level, down to the state, and out to agencies like ours. It's a competitive process, so we compete with every other agency in the state to try to get funding. We get a small pot of funding from Dane County. Mm-hmm. We get a very small pot of funding from the state. We do a lot of fundraising ourselves. We have three big events every year, plus a lot of other smaller events. And we also write applications and grants to local foundations and state and national foundations. It's a big challenge. The economy has sort of been on a roller coaster for the last 11 or 12 years. Some years it's harder than others.
Yeah. And you have a website, so we should. It is safeharborhelpskids.org. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
That is correct.
So all one word, safeharborhelpskids.org. Mm-hmm. ORG, and that has all of the information about the organization, even about if somebody wants to donate or either time or money. I assume there's some need for volunteers on occasion as well.
We do. We use volunteers. The major way we use volunteers is to help us with our big fundraising events. We have one coming up on July 21st, and that's our summer swinging summer rent party. The concept for that came because so often grants don't fund operational expenses, and government grants do not do that. They do not pay for the rent and the utilities. And so one of our board members came up with the idea that we do a rent party, sort of like in after the crash and in the Depression, when people didn't have enough money to pay the rent. The friends and the neighbors got together. You put a little pot on the table. People threw in the change they had, and they had a little music and had a good time. So that's where the concept started. We followed that with a motorcycle ride, and this year we've renamed it the Ron Boylan Motorcycle Ride to Benefit Children, because Ron Boylan was deputy chief for the sheriff's office, and he died recently in February, and he was an outstanding human being, and so we're acknowledging his presence with the ride. And That is in August. And then the Safe Harbor Fun Run Walk Tot Trot is Labor Day Monday.
I like that, tot trot.
that literally is what draws families, because we have an area set up for the little, like, 3-year-olds to 8-year-olds, and they have to go from point A to point B. They all get a T-shirt. They all get a medal. They all get a bag. It's just cool. It is so fun to see, and it's really a family event.
And that's Labor Day weekend.
Labor Day Monday.
I want to put just point people again to your website, which is Safe Harbor helpskids.org, as so that people can learn more. Actually, just go, you can go there and learn more about all of the events that we're talking about here today. And also go to our Facebook page too, because we'll have that posted up on our Facebook page, a link to Safe Harbor and its organization. And so just go to the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page, and you will find that as well. So how do things look? I mean, you know, we've been talking about some serious things. And I guess one of the really positive things that I'm taking away from this is that if there's a child out there in need and has suffered abuse, there are places, Safe Harbor, and certainly in southern Wisconsin, where people can get help and get things turned around.
That's absolutely the truth. We really are committed to helping children that have been abused. One of the things we do is automatically, after we've done the interview of the child, is link the child and the parent. We call that the non-offending caregiver, the person that mm-hmm. has not injured the child. We link them to mental health services right away. We really plug the gaps, and we work with an awesome team of people to get the very best outcomes for the children that we can.
And one more thing. If someone suspects child abuse, what should they do?
They should call either the Human Services Department in the county they live in, or their nearest law enforcement agency, in Madison it could be the Madison Police Department, or it could be the Sheriff's Office, or any one of our small town PDs. It's the same thing in every county. Pick up the phone, call and report it. It's not their job to investigate it. It's not the person's job to try to figure out, is there enough here that makes it important? If it smells like it, if it feels like it, call and report it. There are people out there that will take it from there.
I think that's such an important message, to know that one person can make a really significant difference in the life of a child, and that it's, you call about if you have any concerns. You don't have to worry about, gosh, whether is this true or is it not true. Someone else will figure that out. But if you have a feeling, if something is not seeming right to you about a child or about the way this family's functioning or something that the child has said, that it's all of our obligation as adults and members of the community to take action on behalf of the children who need us.
And just to go back to that Isthmus article for a minute, but which, by the way, you have a link posted on your site, correct?
Yes, we do.
I think that's a very compelling story, mm-hmm. and I certainly invite people. And it's some real positive. I mean, it's hard. Parts of it are hard to read, mm-hmm. but also the positive message that comes out of that is pretty rewarding. It has to be kind of for you both as well.
It is so good to see children come back to us later that, you know, they're doing okay.
Yeah.
They can smile and they can laugh and they can play and they have their lives back.
Yeah. Well, I thank you both for the great work you're doing.
I
also thank you for being with us today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you so much.
Brenda Nelson is the executive director of Safe Harbor, and Jennifer Ginsburg is a forensic interviewer for Safe Harbor, both with master's degrees in social work, licensed social workers. Jennifer's a licensed clinical social worker, so it's great to have them both here, and I expect we'll have them on again at some point. Thank you again. Coming up, we're going to switch gears. We're going to switch to music a little bit and marching band music. It's the 125th anniversary of the University of Wisconsin Marching Band. And Mike LaCrone, director of the band, joins us next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hi, this is Ben Marins, host of At Issue. Hoping you'll join me later today, starting at 4, when we'll talk about a top news story of the day. Then after 5, we'll talk with airline watchdog Mary Schiavo about FAA safety and just how safe it is to fly today. It's all at issue later this afternoon here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thank you for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio, turning our attention to the University of Wisconsin Marching Band. It's their 125th anniversary this year. Mike LaCrone has not been the band director for the entire time.
Thank you for that. I appreciate that.
Mike, it's great to have you with us.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, Larry.
I tell you what, first, 125 years. Do you know much of the history of the band?
I know quite a bit of the history. Years ago, when we celebrated our 100th anniversary, we wrote a band history, and yeah. I was very involved with that. Not only writing a lot of it, but doing the editing on it. So I know quite a bit about it. And you just asked a question. I probably know an answer.
Well, I'm envisioning 125 years ago, one tuba and one horn and a drummer. And
you're pretty close. It was 11 players in 1885. It was formed as an adjunct for the military. As being a land-grant university, they needed something to play for military occasions, and a man named F.O. May put it together. He wasn't particularly a professional musician nor a professor. He just saw the need and put it together. And 11 players was what we started with. The next year it grew to 16, though.
Well, percentage-wise, that's a pretty big
chunk.
That's a big chunk. Oh, it's over the years it grew. How many band and now you sort of have a maximum, I assume, of how many people can be a part of it.
Well, we've put the marching band at 285, which is what the marching band has. But what a lot of people don't know, because the marching band is so visible, we have 5 concert groups that qualify as part of the band department who just play concerts. And so we have about 700 students enrolled in one band or another over the course of a week's rehearsal time.
Oh, so and you're working with all those groups?
No, I work with 2 of the groups. I work with the marching band and one of the concert groups. We have a man named Scott Teeple, who does the wind ensemble and other groups. And then we have some teaching assistants who do the university bands, which are the non-music major bands, kids who just want to play just to keep playing. And it's wonderful. I think it's a great thing for the school to have.
And you have been first let's go back further. I was going to ask you how you got started, but you were a butler.
Butler University, yeah. Quite
so
in the
you
news.
So you were rooting a little bit at the...
not when they played Wisconsin.
No.
I was true to Wisconsin, but no, I was kind of pulling for the Bulldogs to do something after that.
And then PhD work at Indiana
University. And so I was born and raised a Hoosier till I got here in 1969.
Oh, in 69. Man, and I was trying to remember the director who retired ahead of you.
Ray Dvorak, a wonderful man, a legend and a pioneer in the college band business. He was in that position for 34 years, and he sort of set the tone. There were a whole group of early pioneers who sort of established the college band program as we know it now, with the marching band, the concert groups, and all that. And Ray was very much ahead of his time, and I owe a lot to him, because he was very, very helpful to me when I first came.
Yeah. If you'd like to join in, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. Maybe you played in the band. Maybe you got a comment or a shout out to Mike here as we visit with him. Mike LaCrone, been the director of the University of Wisconsin Band since 1969. Ernest in Reidsville, let's go to you. Thank you very much for calling. Hello.
Gentlemen, I'm calling with an idea. I grew up in the state of Ohio, so Ohio has the famous, they spell out the state of Ohio, and then the...
dot the I.
They dot the I, and it shows up in a lot of college advertisement as it's pieced in there. And I always thought Wisconsin should have one. And I envision a block of the band in a block form at the student section. And it starts off marching, and it spreads out into the flying W of the logo of the state of Wisconsin, and you march across the field playing on Wisconsin.
Well, that sounds pretty cool.
Well, we don't do it exactly as you describe it, but at least once or twice during the pregame show, we do that motion W, as they call it. We started adding that to our, and so it appears in the pregame show. We don't make it float, but we just go to, it's kind of an odd-shaped thing. It's yeah, that flying W is really an odd shape. It took us a while to figure out how to do it even.
Okay. All right. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for calling. How much practice time? Speaking of that, your kids have put a lot of practice time in.
Well, it's probably not as much as some people envision, but it sounds like a big chunk of time. We practice an hour and 45 minutes 4 days a week during the football season, which is about average for a college band. It's certainly not as much as some bands practice, and not as a little. Some bands only do 3 days a week, Monday, Wednesday, Fridays. We go Tuesday through Friday. And then, of course, there's an hour on, if there's a game day, we have to put in an hour of just refresher on Saturday morning sometime. But it's not as much as some people would expect us to do. However, our preseason, that's where we go to the 8 to 10 hours a day to get ready for that regular season.
Oh, man, 8 to 10 hours a day.
Yeah, during the kids, we call it registration week still based on the old days when students would come and register. But we'll start at about 10 in the morning and not quit till about 8 at night with some breaks in there. Just people are surprised at how much has to be done before that first game. They sort of take it for granted, but I have to reteach on Wisconsin to about 70 freshmen.
Joe and Franklin up next. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Good morning. I'm a long-suffering Illini. And a few years ago was the band trip to Champaign. And not only did your football team embarrass the football team, but your band embarrassed our band. Our band might be technically very good, but they don't have anywhere near the enthusiasm or spirit or fun that the Badgers do. And it's one of the reasons that I think Camp Randall's student body and just the attendance of the games is so spirited, unlike Illinois, which is I-L-L-I-N-I. That's about the most excitement they generate. So it's just a pleasure to listen to you perform, to watch you perform, Mike.
Well, thank you very much.
And keep it up.
Well, that idea of having fun is one of the things that I firmly believe in. It's very hard work, but if you're not having fun doing it, and we want that to translate into the audience when we perform.
Yeah.
I just wish somehow you could convey that to the marching Illini.
Well, each band has a different kind of personality, doesn't it? You look at the Big Ten bands.
When you see the Big Ten band, everybody, that you hit it right on the nose. There is a different personality for each. And some of that goes back to how it got started, the inception, sort of the concept that they got. Some bands have changed over the years. I think Wisconsin band has changed. Ray Dvorak was a little more conservative in what he did, but at his time he was still well known. I put a little more of a show business thing into the band and what Ray may have done, but Ray was a little more military, he grew up in the John Philip Sousa era, so he had that as a context.
There we go.
You guys, even with you guys leaving the stadium, the shtick that your trumpets or cornets do, blasting someone, much like the Globetrotters throwing confetti, just the whole thing is so much fun.
Well, thanks for noticing, and we'll keep trying to have fun.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Mike in South Milwaukee up with a question for you. Hi, Mike.
Boy, I've been dying to ask this question. I'm a band supporter, and my family endows two snare drums, and I go to all the home and away Big Ten games. Why does Madison never have any Big Ten visiting bands? I look forward to when Wisconsin goes to Ohio State, the Battle of the Bands, and we're really missing something in Madison by never having a visiting band. Could Mike please address that?
Well, it goes back a while. I think part of it, one of the problems that we have now is the problem of budgeting. I mean, it's most of the schools, if you go down to Big Ten, a lot of them have that natural rivalry that they've traveled to. Ohio State and Michigan, they always travel back and forth. Michigan State goes to Michigan, and Michigan goes back and forth. There's a lot of natural rivalries that we don't qualify. That's one of the reasons I think it is. I think it's more than one reason. I think part of the reason is the fact that we're kind of far away. Minnesota doesn't get a lot of bands travel up there unless it's us, because we're kind of out of that Midwest thing. I don't know what's going to happen with Nebraska joins, because that band is really well noted for being able to travel. I think there's some other things. Since we redesigned the stadium, we didn't, and I think part of that goes back to some, maybe someone overlooked it, we didn't look to have a place to put the visiting bands when that stadium got renovated. Now, before that, we did have places, but I can tell you from other experiences, you know, there was a point where Madison was sort of considered a city that you didn't want to bring students to and let them stay overnight, or because you know, of the notoriety of some things. That they had some problems, obviously, in the, well, when I came here, there was the problems of the campus unrest, and that people dwell on that. Well, it's not a reality, but they talk about it. And I think there's a whole combination of reasons. But I think now with budgeting and with fuel prices and what it costs to take a band someplace, I think really honestly the one thing is we're a little bit too far off the beaten path. I still don't see a reason why Iowa and Minnesota can't come regularly. But as I said, they have some of their natural normal visiting places, which infringes on them doing it.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Connor in Appleton, on to you now. Hi, Connor.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I wanted to call in and kind of, I guess, build off the Illini fans comment about the fun and the energy. If anyone hasn't been and even moderately enjoys the marching band, the spring concert is phenomenal. I had never been until I was working at the Kohl Center. And, you know, we're working, so we're not supposed to necessarily be enjoying the event, but how could you not? It was such a blast. Mr. LeCun, I think you were lowered in from the rafters the year that I was there.
I've been known to do that, yes. Thanks for the plug. We're getting ready for it this week. It's a big thing for us.
Oh, it is a wonderful thing. We'll be talking some more about it. And that's another thing that takes an awful lot of time, I would expect. Back to plan.
It does. The planning really will start for next year's show sometime in June. It'll give us a chance to clear our heads a little bit. But we'll start, and we started on this year's show back in last June when we sort of did an evaluation on where we were, what we did, what we can do, and what we need to do that's different. And we look forward to it every year.
Mike LeCrone, who is director of the University of Wisconsin Marching Band since 1969, he's our guest up until 12:30 here today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.